This is New Hampshire Public Radio News. It's 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. New Hampshire's mental health system has been under financial strain for a long time, with year after year of recession-related budget cuts. But bipartisan support has emerged for shoring up the system, and this year, mental health got a $28 million boost in the budget. Chalk it up to ever louder concerns expressed by a coalition of mental health professionals, local police, emergency room doctors, and families of those in crisis. And perhaps also chalk it up to the heartbreaking massacre of 20 first graders and 6 adults at an elementary school in Newtown, Connecticut, right before Christmas last year. It's unclear what the shooter, Adam Lanza's, psychiatric history was that led to that day. Some say there were warning signs. But in many other recent mass shootings, there were gaps in the mental health system that seemed to have allowed these people to perpetrate mass violence. So after Newtown and other tragedies, many Granite Staters said that the mental health system must be fixed in hopes of preventing yet another tragedy. And their sentiment has been reflected nationwide. 37 states increased mental health spending this year, and this week, Vice President Biden said the federal government would kick in $100 million more dollars, adding to those efforts. But while these increases are welcomed, some feel the mental health focus is misguided, that it unfairly tags people with mental illness as dangerous, and that it hides the real problem behind these massacres, easy access to guns. Today in The Exchange, part two in our series of lessons from Newtown, we look at this issue of mental health. Let's hear from you. What attention do you see mental health receiving after Newtown? What changes, if any, to our mental health system are needed to possibly prevent these kinds of tragedies in the future? And how have your own thoughts about mental health changed after Newtown? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. We have three guests in studio. Ken Norton is here, Executive Director of the New Hampshire Chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And Ken, welcome back. It's good to see you.
Good morning.
Also with us, Mark Sioka, psychologist at Capital Valley Counseling Associates, former Director of Emergency Services at Riverbend Community Mental Health. And Mark, welcome back. Thank you for your time.
Glad to be here.
Also with us, Robert Murray, psychiatrist and medical director of Riverbend Community Mental Health, based in Concord. And Robert Murray, a welcome back to you, too. Thank you.
Thank you, Laura.
Well, I want to turn to you first, Robert, but hear from everybody. How do you feel about all the focus on mental health with this terrible event and the one-year anniversary and other massacres like it? What do you think?
I think it's very understandable when the public looks at these kinds of behaviors that are so outrageous, hurtful, astounding, to think, to have the automatic reaction, these individuals, anyone doing this, must have some type of mental problem or mental disorder. So I think it's very natural for the question to arise. And as that question arises, usually the corollary is, why were these people not getting some type of help? Why were these people not identified? Shouldn't we have the ability to predict or recognize an individual who could do a thing like this and prevent the tragedy?
Those are two pieces of the puzzle, and I'm glad you mentioned that. Not only did this person get the help they needed, would that have helped, but how do you even identify who among us might do this? What do you think, Mark Sioka? How do you feel about all the attention on mental health? We talked about guns yesterday, but the attention since Newtown has also been on mental health. I wonder what you think about that.
Well, number one, it's kind of tragic. And I was talking just last year prior to Newtown with a man who advocates for people with bipolar disorder, and we were lamenting the state of the mental health system at that time. And unfortunately, prophetically, I had said to him, it usually takes some kind of tragedy for the mental health system to get the funding and the reorganization that it needs. So it's sad to say, but I saw this kind of thing happening. The second thing I have to say is I always have concern when people say the mentally ill, as if that is one type of person, when actually mental illness is anything from your average person out there working who has depression or anxiety to somebody with severe and persistent mental illness who has a hard time maintaining a place to live and having funds to find something to eat. So I always cringe when I hear the mentally ill, the mentally ill.
You know, that's a valid point. The idea, Mark, and correct me if I'm wrong, that most people think the mentally ill is this sort of separate, distinct, other population. But in fact, you're saying it's more fluid than that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What do you think, Ken Norton? I know you've been kind of upset at the way mental health has been presented in these massacres, including, of course, Newtown.
Sure. I mean, I think that there's good and bad that has come out of this. Certainly much more conversations and dialogue that really needs to take place. But as Mark said, sadly, things that advocates have been talking about for years that have been being ignored. I mean, we've seen $4 billion in state cuts since 2009 to the mental health system. And, you know, that pales in comparison, for instance, to the $100 million that Vice President Biden committed yesterday to a system that's very much been in crisis. But there have been a lot more conversations with neighbors, with families, with schools, with legislators, in the professions that are treating people with mental illness, and I think that those conversations have been important. And one other piece that I would add that hasn't gotten a lot of attention is the whole media piece, and that how the media reports on mental illness. And one of the things that was very interesting was post Newtown, the Associated Press finally for the first time included guidelines in their style book for reporting on mental illness and essentially saying you should not associate a violent act with a mental illness unless you have firsthand and sourced knowledge of how that act connects with this person's diagnosis.
Yeah, there's that natural human reaction, kind of what Robert said. You know, to do this, you must be crazy.
Mm-hmm.
That's how most of us sort it out.
For sure.
What do you think about Vice President Biden's $100 million then, Ken Norton? Sounds like you feel like that's not very impressive.
I mean, it's certainly welcome, but if you divide that by 50, you know, we're looking at $2 million per state. And, you know, and when you contrast that with what I said before was, you know, $4 billion in cuts over the last 5 years across all of our states.
All right, I have a lot more questions for all of you. But again, I want you to join us as well with your comments and questions at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, today in The Exchange, part two of our series on lessons from Newtown. We looked at the gun debate yesterday. Today, we're looking at this issue of mental health. What kind of attention do you see mental health receiving after Newtown? What changes, if any, are needed in our mental health system to possibly prevent these kinds of tragedies in the future? Again, our number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Robert Murray, I want to get back to what you said right at the outset, not only getting help for folks in crisis, but identifying who might perpetrate these terrible, terrible acts. How much of a link is there between mental illness and the folks who do these massacres? It seems like in a lot of them, there is a link. So how much of an identifier or a marker is mental illness for this?
Well, I think that it is a marker, a factor, but it is one of many. It is in some ways an easier one to identify and label and put a finger on, but the reality is that there are a number of factors that may increase the risk of violence and violence being perpetrated. I mean, for instance, we haven't talked about, you talked yesterday about the role of easy access to firearms, but we have a society in which there is very easy access to intoxicating drugs that have an effect on people's impulse control and capacity to manage their emotions and often affect judgment in a way that leads to violence, not just the kind of violence we're talking about today, but violence also comes on a spectrum. Violence begins with small but very meaningful things like domestic violence and the kinds of things that affect our families on a day-to-day basis. You know, a shooting like this is fortunately a relatively rare event, but there is violence every day of the week perpetrated in American families by individuals who are, you know, under the influence of intoxicating substances. We also know that people are more prone to violence when they're highly stressed, and we have an economy in which many of our families are reeling with the stress of how they're going to put another meal on the table or teetering on the edge of homelessness. So mental illness, and especially untreated mental illness, is a risk factor for violence, but it is by no means the only risk factor.
Then why do we keep looking at that as a risk factor?
I think it's easy to identify. It's easy to point to, and there's that kind of knee-jerk sense of, I want to understand this. This is other and to me. I can't relate to having done this. Therefore, this person must be different from me. And as Ken was pointing out, mental illness doesn't identify a special population so awfully different from all of us, but we sometimes think about it that way, and the idea is prevalent in the population in general that this is a different kind of person, a different group of people.
You know, Mark Sciocca, what about substance abuse that Robert raises? I mean, could someone in a raging drunk state or super high on some drug, I mean, is that a temporary mental illness? Can we really separate out substance abuse and mental illness when it comes to these cases of extreme violence? Or should we just, you know, lump it all together?
Well, actually, if you look at the statistics on mental illness and violence, the only group of people with serious mental illness that have a statistically higher rate of violence are the people with mental illness and substance abuse problems together. Otherwise, mental illness in and of itself, it does not predict violence any more than being an ordinary member of the population. So it's that combination of mental illness and substance abuse that is statistically more dangerous.
All right. More to follow up on after a short break. Lots of calls to our number here in the exchange for you to join us. 1-800-892-6477. Send us a short email, exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. As the year draws to a close, consider how much you've learned from NHPR in 2013. How much is the latest news worth to you? How much is it worth to have that news wherever and whenever you need it? Whether it's $100 or $1,000, you can make your tax-deductible year-end gift at NHPR.org today. And thank you. More on assessing mental health care 1 year after Newtown on The Exchange and a 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, a look at the deteriorating situation in the Ukraine. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from New Hampshire Catholic Charities. Legacy giving to Catholic Charities supports and strengthens the lives of people facing hardship now and in the future. NH-CC.org. And from the Monchari Museum of Science in Norwich, Vermont, featuring toys, The Inside Story, now through January 19th, revealing how popular toys work, Monchari.org. It's 9:20. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, part two of our series on lessons from Newtown. We're looking at the issue of mental health, how the conversation has evolved since that terrible day when 20 children and six educators were killed at an elementary school. What kind of attention do you see mental health receiving after Newtown? What kinds of changes do you think are needed to possibly prevent these kinds of tragedies in the future? How have your own thoughts about mental health changed after Newtown? We'd love to hear from you this morning. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or post a comment on our Facebook page. NHPR Exchange, all one word. And gentlemen, before we go to our listeners, Ken Norton, I did want to hear from you as well. This is a really important point. The idea of mental illness possibly being a marker for violence, but when you add in substance abuse, it gets a lot more scary. Go ahead. I'd love your thoughts there.
Well, sure. Just following what Mark said, obviously that highest risk population are those folks that have both a mental illness and a substance use disorder. But from a science perspective, if you look at the research, people who have a substance use disorder have a much higher correlation to violence than those with mental illness. And yet in the public's mind and in the policy mind, we focus on mental illness. For instance, with gun background checks, the focus has been on mental illness and not on substance use disorders.
So how do you feel about that? What would you like to see change around that?
Well, I think that the focus really needs to be on dangerousness, and there's another element that's sort of beyond mental illness and substance abuse, which is there are dangerous people, bad people like the Carl Dragas of the world, many of whom are known to us, that live in our communities that are just bad characters.
That's a really interesting point. So instead of talking about, you know, mental illness and people being withdrawn or being loners or whatever, let's focus on something you call dangerousness. What do you think, Robert?
Oh, I think it's a very valid point that there are individuals who perpetrate violence, who are dangerous members of society, who really only by stretching the criteria can be discussed really as mentally ill. You know, that mental illness is a great umbrella under which there are many, many different categories. If you say mental illness is anything that's listed in the diagnostic manual, then it's a very large umbrella. But the reality is that the mental illness that is really meaningfully thought of that way, and that's what we've been talking about, people with depression, people with schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, are not, and the evidence keeps pointing to this, not a particularly violent group of people. If you stretch that definition to include people who come under various forms of sociopathy, and that's really a technical term for individuals who have very little regard for the rights and well-being of others and a strong sense of personal entitlement to do whatever they please, if you don't consider those people as having some type of mental illness and recognize that that is the type of person, Ken was alluding to this, that we don't understand well. We don't understand well what causes that. We know some of the risk factors. But that is an extremely dangerous group of people, much more so than even the average person using substances or the average person with a diagnosable mental illness.
Okay, so Mark, I have to ask you this, and then I promise if you're waiting on the line, we'll get to you in just a moment. But so, Mark, let's say that in your work as a psychologist, you encounter someone who you consider dangerous, a threat to the public, to their families, perhaps. What do you do about that?
Well, by law, all of us as professionals are required to either hospitalize that person and or report that person to the police. Now, what happens throughout that process, you know, that's a different story. The police may choose to arrest or not arrest that person. The hospital may choose to treat that person or not treat that person, but that is the obligation that we as professionals have. But I think it's more important to try to intervene earlier than that, and certainly there's a model that I and Elaine Frank, former director of injury prevention at Dartmouth, have developed for suicide prevention that I think would work very well in this context.
Yeah, and I know we've talked about that on this program, but in terms of people who are going to go out and do something dreadful in society, you are obligated to report that concern to the police, Mark.
Yes, and or hospitalize that person.
What does that do to the trust, to the relationship that you as a psychologist have with that patient? Would he or she, you know, worry, I better not tell Mark that I'm having these, you know, violent thoughts because he might report me?
Well, and that is an issue, and that's often an issue with suicide too, is some people know about that law and fail to disclose. But I have to say, over the many years that I worked with people who had serious mental illnesses and I had to hospitalize or report, most of them were, once they were improved with treatment, they were grateful. They didn't like some of the other outcomes, but they were grateful.
All right, let's go to our listeners. Lots of people who want to jump in our conversation. Your calls are welcome at 1-800-892-6477. Email, keep them short, exchange@nhpr.org, or post a short comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And let's go first to Linda in Peterborough. Hi, Linda. You're on the air. Thank you.
Hello.
Go ahead, Linda.
I'm calling about the effect that the HIPAA law, the Health Information Privacy Act, I'm not sure what the rest of the letters are for, has on families who are trying to get help for individuals over 18 years of age. And this includes individuals with substance abuse or addictive problems. I have had personal experience as well as talking to many other parents who have tried to get help for their adult children, or even siblings who have tried to get help for their adult brothers or sisters. And it is a terrible, terrible process if you can actually even get someone the services they need. Usually you have to go to court, and it only, in some, it depends on the state. Some states you can only get the person held for 48 hours, and then you have to go back to court again.
Wow.
So, and if you look at the number of individuals who have done these violent acts, they were all over 18. Well, aside from the school shootings of children in school.
The Columbine in 1999, right.
They're all over 18.
Yes. And no, it's a great point, Linda, and thank you for making it. I'm not sure who wants to address that. Ken, the HIPAA law, we all know it. When we go to the doctor, we have to sign this form saying, you know, yes, I know you're going to respect my privacy. She's saying it hinders people who want to get help for anyone over age 18.
Sure. Thank you, Linda. That's a great call. I mean, we all know that outcomes are better when families are educated and involved. And I can speak from my own personal experience with my own family member calling to make a mental health appointment. And being told, oh, no, you know, you can't make that appointment. They have to call themselves. And while, you know, they don't have a phone, they don't have access to a phone, I'll be providing the No. And, you know,
wow, so how do you get around that?
If I called their primary care provider's office, I would not have gotten that response. And I think that HIPAA is, you know, sadly one of the most misinterpreted laws. I mean, that is not what the intention of the law was. And I think healthcare providers in general need to make much more effort about including families or caregivers in and working to provide them the information necessary so that the safety net is there.
So are you saying right now, Ken, there's really no good way to get around it? You have to struggle like our caller has.
Well, I think it requires, I think number one, we need better education about what HIPAA really is because it is misinterpreted. And number two, we need healthcare providers to really see that involving families is an important part of a treatment process.
Wow. Maybe those family members don't want to get sued because they violated HIPAA, or those health providers don't want to get sued because they violated HIPAA.
Well, it's not necessarily about violating it. It's about explaining, taking the time to explain to the patient why it's important and what information. They're not going to tell the deepest, darkest secrets, but they're going to talk about what the warning signs are and where help is available and, you know, some of those things.
Let's take another call. And Deb is in Pembroke. Hi, Deb. You're on the Exchange. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks, Kylie, and thank you for taking my call. I've got a couple points. First of all, I live in recovery from a serious persistent mental illness and was completely shaken to the core with Sandy Hook and all the other atrocities that have happened recently and in the past. I think one of the points I want to make is safe messaging around these events that we need to draw attention to and how they're portrayed and advertised in the media. The other point I want to make is with regards to how we go forward with this, and that is to take a serious step back and start promoting recovery with mental illness. There is so much stigma that surrounds it that oftentimes those that have it don't even recognize or even want to admit that they need the help. So I think showing that recovery is possible, giving that opportunity for somebody with a mental illness to let them know that they can get help and that there is a journey of recovery that they can experience, and that it's like any other mental, it's like any other medical situation. If they can look at their mental illness as if they had another medical condition that's easily treated, maybe they would go and get the help without having to be stigmatized to get it.
If the help were available, because sometimes that's an issue too, right, Deb?
That point as well.
Yeah.
The other brief point I want to make is the gun issue. And again, access to military-style weaponry, to me, is just unnecessary. There's no purpose of having a military-styled weapon to go hunting.
Okay.
And so access for those kinds of weapons, I think, needs to be addressed and get taken out of easy access for those that can get them.
And we definitely had a very, as I said, lively conversation about guns here yesterday. So I'm going to leave that part aside. But what do you think, Robert Murray? You know, we need to remove the stigma. Every time we talk about mental illness, we get back to this word and let folks know that, yes, you can seek help. And yes, you could even recover or live successfully. It sounds like Deb is living.
Well, it's an extremely, extremely important and valid point that Deb's making here. And this is a dialogue that's been going on for a very long time. It's very clear all the negative effects that the stigmatization of the mentally ill have on access to treatment, people feeling free to talk. And yet, I think we've made some progress over the past 50 years, but there's a long way to go. As she points out, there is still a strong negative reaction to mental illness, a fear of that reaction. Sometimes that fear is exaggerated, but there is enough reality to that that, you know, people who are in recovery really have to think long and hard about how far they go sharing that experience. There are some—
Because people look at them funny. What's the matter with you?
I mean, Ken can speak to, I think, a very valuable program that the National Alliance has for speakers to bring out their stories of recovery. And we need more of that.
All right. Well, Deb, thanks a lot for calling, and good luck to you. You know, as we talked earlier, sometimes it's a case of people seeking help. Sometimes it's a case of the help not being there or difficulties with HIPAA. Sometimes in these cases, like Newtown, investigators go back, look at the person's earlier years, talk about were there identifying markers, as you mentioned earlier, Robert Murray, that might have given us a hint that this person would perpetrate these acts of violence. Joining us now more for a little bit on that is Ellen Cohn. She's a social psychologist at UNH, coordinator of the Justice Studies program there. And Ellen Cohn, good to have you. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
So let's talk about the schools, because often when these things happen, you know, reporters go back to the schools and they say, what was this person like? Was there any indication that he might have caused trouble? I say he because most of the time these are young men. What sorts of behaviors today are schools looking out for, Ellen, when it comes to young people who might become violent?
Yeah,
Laura, sure.
I just wanted to say that I listened to the program before, and I just wanted to acknowledge the MacArthur Research Network on Mental Health and the Law, because they did the study that your guests were talking about, where they found that mentally ill are no more likely to be violent than the general population. But mentally ill who have a substance abuse diagnosis are more likely to be involved in community violence.
Sure, that's
an
important
point. So that is a risk factor.
Yeah.
And schizophrenia is actually a negative risk factor, which I think your guest talked about. When it comes to schools, I think schools are in a hard place because they want to do something. But what we know about schools, what we know about school shootings are that it's a very rare event. And some of the efforts that schools have made have not been the most successful ones because people still come in as evidence of Newtown. One of the things that schools have tried is a zero-tolerance policy where higher penalties are given for small behaviors. We found that that just doesn't work very well.
For example, Ellen?
For example, students who do minor kinds of infractions, not coming to school, things like that, are given harsh penalties. And what we have found is that disproportionately minorities are given these penalties. In fact, the state of Florida, particularly Broward County, there was an article in the New York Times that they're eliminating zero tolerance. Another tendency in general, but in schools in particular, is this idea of profiling, which is what you're asking about. Is there a certain kind of person who's more likely to do these school shootings?
Yeah, especially after Columbine, this was
especially,
an issue. Right,
right.
Go ahead.
And one of the problems is we have so few cases of this that even the FBI behavioral unit said we cannot profile. Profiling will not work. We do know some things from a study done by the Secret Service and the Department of Education. And as you point out, all the attackers are boys. Usually guns are the weapon of choice. And often these are people who showed signs of needing help. 75% of them threatened or tried to commit suicide. So profiling based, what happens is if you profile, what you find is that people will be identified as being at risk for doing these things, and most people who fit the profile will not engage in the behavior, and some students who are planning and preparing will be missed because they don't feel fit the profile.
Boy, so every time you come up with a profile...
you have to be real. And if the FBI behavioral unit is saying it doesn't work, what they suggest works better is to do what they call threat assessment. And what threat assessment is, schools often know a lot of... What we do know is that often these shooters don't act impulsively. They've been planning it. And either other students know it, people know it. Sometimes even school resource officers know it because they often have the pulse of the school. And so what has been suggested is instead to use, this was came out of a meeting between the Secret Service, the FBI, and the Department of Education, and having schools assess what the threat is, to use threat assessment.
Through information provided by those on the ground.
Right. This is based on a 1999 conference with 160 experts. And what they said is that it's important to use this because then the investigation is triggered by the student's threatening or concerning behavior. Some examples for your guests. A high school student posts on Facebook that he's considering killing himself and individuals on a hit list. That obviously is an example.
That
a
seems
student
like
shows classmates a knife at school.
Ellen Cohn, if you could hold on, please. We're going to take a very short break, and I'll let you wrap up after that. So stay with us. We'll be back in a minute.
More of The Exchange coming up on New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the latest on unrest in Ukraine and the future of the former Soviet Republic's economic ties with the EU. Then, what's behind the increase in spinal fusion surgeries and why some medical experts are concerned. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes to us from Rothweigel Dental Care in Bedford and Comprehensive Family and Cosmetic Dentistry, devoted to restoring and enhancing the natural beauty of your smile. Information at rothweigeldentalcare.com. And from Small Dog Electronics, offering Dr. Small Dog house calls for home and business, Mac and PC technical service and repair, online at smalldog.com/doctor. 940, this is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, part two of our series, Looking Back at Newtown. We're looking this hour at mental health issues. Yesterday, we talked about the conversation around guns in connected with this terrible incident at an elementary school and other incidents like it. We'd like to hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page. NHPR Exchange, that's all one word. And we were on the line before the break with Ellen Cohn, social psychologist at UNH, coordinator of the Justice Studies Program at UNH. And Ellen, just before the break, you were saying, look, profiling doesn't really work. Zero tolerance doesn't really work. What does work is what you called threat assessment. And you were starting to get into how you assess those threats. Why don't you wrap that up for us, please?
Okay, sure. There are a number of questions that you can ask in threat assessment. Has the student shown inappropriate interest in any of the following: school attacks or attackers, weapons, incidents of mass violence? Does the student have the capacity to carry out an act of targeted violence? In relation to your program on mental illness, is the student experiencing hopelessness, desperation, and or despair? And this is what I consider to be one of the most important questions. If it is a student doing this, does the student have a trusting relationship with at least one responsible adult? In my research on adolescents, we find that a lot of adolescents do not have a trusting relationship. Sometimes it's a teacher becomes the only person that they can talk to. Sometimes they don't even have that. So that's important.
Well, Ellen, thank you very much for joining us. We appreciate it. We're going to talk about some of the findings that you had among our panel and with our listeners. Thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.
Ellen Cohn, social psychologist at UNH, coordinator of the Justice Studies program there. Again, the number for your phone calls, your thoughts and questions, 1-800-892-6477. The email is exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange. All one word. And gentlemen, I do want to go to you very briefly. Ken Norton, I'm wondering if there's some parents listening to us right now, listening to Ellen Cohn and going, boy, does my kid fit into some of that, I don't want to say profile, but some of those markers that Ellen talked about.
I'm sure there's many, many families. I mean, we certainly hear a lot from parents of transition age youth, and by transition age, I mean, you know, youth that are moving from childhood to adulthood through the latter teen years and early adult years, that they're isolated, that they spend a lot of time in their bedroom playing video games or on the internet, and they don't seem to have strong relationships with other folks.
So what would you say to those parents going, oh, is my kid capable of doing this? I'm a little worried about him, and I have to say him because, again, it does seem to be boys.
And yes, it does.
And young men.
It does tend to be boys and young men. I mean, I think one of the things that we would say is you know, have you talked with them about what are they hopeful for? What do they think about their future? Do they have goals? I mean, do they connect with anybody? Have they been assessed for depression? Do you think that there's substance abuse involved? Some of those questions that I think are key. And some of it's to not pathologize what in some ways has become normal teen behavior. And I think that that's part of what Ellen, you know, points out is the difficulty of determining, okay, you know, I mean, you know, maybe this person has great relationships with people online, but, you know, their parents are, you know, folks may not know that.
Yeah, and it is tricky to sort out what's normal and what isn't. I mean, some boys like to play with guns. I have for a long time. A lot of teenage boys, the thing they do when they get home from school is go up to their rooms and close the door. You know, they just don't want to talk to their parents, so it's tricky to sort it out. Mark, did you want to just give us your thoughts there as well, and then we'll go back to our listeners?
Well, I'm going to be a little passionate about this. If somebody meets that kind of profile, the people around them need to be counseled to remove their access to lethal means.
What Nancy Lanza did not do.
Whether it be guns or machetes or whatever they have. I'm a gun owner. I'm not talking about government gun control. I'm talking about the families, the physicians, a counselor, school people, all having a dialogue about voluntarily getting that guns to a friend from the gun club or whoever could safely keep those guns away from that person, because it's the access to the lethal means that is also a big factor in these types of shootings, obviously, but also in the suicides, which frankly far outnumber these incidents.
So as a gun owner yourself, Mark, you're saying family members have a responsibility there.
Yes. Yes, they do. And, you know, we can talk all about the government sweeping in and doing it, but family members have a responsibility, and the professionals who work with the family members have a responsibility to have that discussion.
All right. Let's go back to our listeners, and then perhaps, Robert, I want to hear from you, too. Tom's waiting in Nashua. Hi, Tom. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Hi. I hope I can make sense because I had to run up the stairs to get to the phone.
Give it a try, Tom.
I think the whole piece that's missing in this conversation and in conversations that I have heard before is the consumer. There, if you have cancer, you can make a connection with a person who has cancer faster and easier than you can with a doctor or with your therapist or whatever. And we as consumers, and I am one, do not have the opportunity to be involved in the treatment that we receive and have a voice in all of these legislative processes that they're going through. I testified approximately 3 years, about 2009, in front of the Senate committee that was going to make these unbelievable cuts to DHHS, and I told them, I says, you pay now or you pay within the prison system, within the police departments. I am ashamed to say that the violence is going to go up because people are not going to have the services that we need.
So when you say consumer, Tom, you mean the voice of patients, people with mental illness. Is that what you mean?
Yes.
Yeah.
I am one. And one other thing that is never mentioned that I have ever heard is New Hampshire is the only state in the nation that has peer support for mental illness as its model. And we connect with people who have mental illness on a completely different level than what they get professionally. If I am involved in some type of activity that requires the police, the last person I want to see is the police officer because of history. The second worst would be my psychiatrist. And my third would be my therapist. I want to see somebody who understands me, who's been there, who's done that. And that is what's missing in this entire system.
This is a very powerful phone call. Tom, thank you so much for calling in. Robert Murray, what do you think?
Well, I think the caller makes a very valid point. Probably the weakest link in the system is really universal access to peer counseling and the really useful input from other individuals who are in treatment for a mental illness. This state does recognize that value, but I think to a much more limited degree than would be ideal. It's not an ideal access by any means. It's there. It's part of the spirit and intent. But I think peer access to peer support and counseling is as limited as access to all other forms of useful treatment for mental illness in this state and many others. We're not unique, but I think Ken pointed out earlier the degree to which mental health services have been cut in their funding over the past 10 years is a remarkable fact. I mean, if you contemplate that fact, it's then possible to put into perspective things like, you know, Vice President Biden's very commendable announcement, but compared with those cuts, it's a drop in the bucket.
100 million.
Our governor, I think, definitely supports mental health services and has made a certain number of millions of dollars available. But compared with the amount that the New Hampshire system has been cut prior to that, it's really a small Band-Aid. And the other thing is that there are hidden cuts. It's one thing to have a cut, but we have just had the benefits for many people with mental illness received through Medicaid turned over to three bidders from the private sector.
This is Medicaid managed
really
care.
Have no concept. It's obvious in the first 2 weeks of this as it's playing out. They have no concept that they are now responsible for covering the lives of people with very severe mental illnesses. They really have no experience doing this. With a mandate to remove a number of millions of dollars from the system.
So you're saying when they put those bids in to the state saying we can manage this Medicaid program better than you, more cheaply than you, they didn't realize what they were getting into when it came to mental health? Is that what you're saying?
But what they have put on the line is we promise to pull X amount of money out of the system, and we will pull X amount of money out to pay our shareholders because we are for-profit organizations and we have to pay a dividend to our shareholders.
Kendron, what do you think about Tom's call? Tom, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, I think Tom makes a very important point and just want to let people know that that we do have 10 regional peer support agencies in the state, as well as a program called Granite Pathways in Manchester. And the state has an Office of Consumer and Family Affairs through the Bureau of Behavioral Health, and that could direct people to those regional peer support agencies. Certainly, as Tom said, peer support is a very important part of a recovery process. We see that in the substance abuse field. We see it with veterans. We see it in lots of different groups. And we can probably get the link to the Office of Consumer Affairs up on the Exchange website after the show if people want to find out how to access that.
Absolutely. Our website, nhpr.org. I'll get that information from you later, Ken, and we'll put it on the website. You know, it was interesting to me, too, from Tom's call, Mark Sciocca. He said, you know, if I'm having a crisis, I don't want to see a police officer, for sure. I don't want to see my therapist. You know, I don't want to see those people. It almost felt like that those people, as well-meaning as they might be, A, don't understand, and B, maybe even would be sort of talking down to him.
Well, I would hope that that's not true for the vast majority of people. I would hope that most therapists have a relationship. That's the foundation of psychotherapy. And you know, what's left out, and I think that the heroes and heroines of mental health in my mind over the years that I worked in mental health were the case managers. So many times it was the case managers that identified the people with the problem. The case managers are the bachelor's level people who go out to the homes, who provide transportation for the people, who check on them, who make sure they're taking their medication, who bring them to their psychiatric appointments. They form a relationship with the person, and that is often the foundation of community mental health. And I think a lot of concern is, are these managed care programs going to cover that case management? Because if you take that out of the equation, you take a huge aspect of mental health, community mental health, out of the equation.
Here's an email that just came in from Alex. It says, please address the issue of not enough beds at New Hampshire Hospital. Alex also says, also on HIPAA, what gets reported to the background check system? I'm going to assume Alex is talking about guns there, but I'm not 100% sure. What about the issue of not enough beds, Robert Murray at New Hampshire Hospital? Someone's in the throes of a crisis and there's no place to put them.
There are not enough beds at New Hampshire Hospital. It's a reality.
Didn't they just add 12?
Yes, but again, compared with the number of beds lost over the past 20 years, you know, from the time when the adult psychiatric service building was built, we are still in the red, as it were, in terms of beds. At the same time that over the past 20 years, this has become a much more populous state than it was when that building was built.
Ken, real quick.
It's not just New Hampshire Hospital. It's the closure of psychiatric units at local general hospitals. But the real issue is about community capacity to prevent the need for people going into crisis and needing a hospital bed.
Getting back to Newtown, gentlemen, and that's how we started our conversation. And I want to close out there. What do you think, Ken Norton? You know, as we look back at this, as we move forward, what do you hope happens in terms of this conversation, in terms of public attitudes about mental health that might prevent future tragedies? That's always the hope. You got to remain hopeful.
Well, I think very simply stated, it should be as easy to get a mental health appointment as it is to purchase a firearm, and it's not. And for substance abuse treatment, it's even worse. There's less capacity, less reimbursement, less access. And so we need to do much better in terms of taking that stigma away so that the 50% of people who do have mental illnesses and don't ask for help feel more comfortable getting help.
Now, in the Newtown case, Ken, I know you know this, there was no evidence of substance abuse, even really no evidence of, you know, other mass shooters have had psychiatric incidents and official reports and so forth. In this instance, there was none of that either.
Well, and I think to Mark's point, you know, part of that was that, you know, and not to blame her, but the family should have recognized that this person was not doing okay and should have taken steps to remove the firearms from the house.
How do you hope this goes forward, Mark Sciocca?
Well, I hope that, as Ken said, that people who know that there are people within their families or even friends who are having trouble will try to reach out to them about their access to lethal means and help remove the guns from those people who are threatening. Again, there's no way that I know of that any kind of gun control related to that is ever going to be passed, and I'm not sure I would want that. But we need to become educated as individuals when someone's having a difficult time. Get the lethal means away from them.
Okay. I'm going to give you the last word, Robert Murray. Go ahead.
Well, I agree with everything that's been said, and I think that a important tool in preventing this type of dreadful outcome is to have ready access to mental health assessment and services. I could not agree with Ken Moore. We need to make that as easy as purchasing a gun or as easy as getting an appointment with one's primary care doctor.
Okay. All of you, thank you very much. Tough topic. I really appreciate you being here. Thank you. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our volunteer is Alan Cohen. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoi, and tomorrow on The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. The Granite State joins seven others in the Northeast asking the EPA to crack down on air pollution coming into the region. More details emerge on the investigation of Rockingham County Attorney Jim Reams, including complaints from female employees. And after more debate than you might expect, UNH has finalized a new logo. Send us your thoughts by email, Facebook, and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, the Diane Rehm Show, next at 10 o'clock. Support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes to us from The Telegraph, providing local news coverage and advertising opportunities for today's complexities online at nashuatelegraph.com. And from Symphony New Hampshire Orchestra and Chorus presents Renaissance and Baroque holiday favorites with Messiah and Company December 15th in Nashua. Tickets at symphonynh.org.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord 89.1.
WEVS Nashua 88.3.
WEVH Hanover 91.3.
WEVN Keene 90.7.
WEVC Gorham 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
It is 10 o'clock.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. The president of Ukraine may have had a change of heart. He has told the European Union's foreign policy chief he intends to sign the trade deal with the EU that he rejected just last month. The news comes after the U.S. said it was disgusted by government crackdowns on protesters in Kyiv.